Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everybody. This is a very exciting live broadcast. I am here today with patron Colin Bergstrand. Hi, Colin.
Hi.
And he has done 30, no less than 30, OMS, which is the original mountain marathon. And we're going to hear all about it today. He's just told me that his running partner, John, who he's done these 30 with, they've never had a fight. So I completely don't agree with, I don't believe that at all. We're going to find out all of the interesting gossip today, hear from Colin. And hopefully John will find his way onto the live chat so that he can be like, no, Colin, it wasn't like that at all. And put things straight. We've got a couple of pictures as well to show you as well as we go through. But first of all, Colin, can I just ask you to explain what exactly is the OMS for people who don't know or have never heard of it before?
Yeah, so I don't know if I get any awards for being the oldest person on your stream, but I think for everybody there, the OMS was really something that started many years ago by a guy called Jerry Charnley. And it was a mountain race. I think it was 68 that it actually started going. And really, it was the forerunner of all adventure racing before it got popular. So it's a two-day mountain orienteering event. And the reason he put it together was basically he thought it was the big challenge for mountain runners or people in the outdoors to basically be self-sufficient in the mountain for mountains for 2 days. And so it just started and it sort of snowballed. And certainly in the late 80s, before all, you know, trail running and adventure racing started, it was sort of the mountain running event that, you know, really all, you know, Joss Naylor was in it, he won the elite events. And what was also good, and the really thing for people to understand there, a lot of it as well is there's a key part of it is navigation. So you really need to be pretty sharp on your map skills and navigation to do well in it. And so it's something that attracted John and I, and that's what the OMS is, and we started, and it seemed to just snowball from there, really.
Yeah, and it's really quite hard to do because it takes place at the end of October, doesn't it, every year? So you've got that, the clocks go forward, so you've got an extra hour, which you think, oh, that's great, extra hour of sleep. But actually, if you're in a tiny tent kind of sandwiched next to somebody who might smell or fart or, you know, be sweaty because there's no showers, is there, in the middle of nowhere. So it's two days
total self-sufficiency in terms of what you get. You get some water is basically as much as it was. And I think that you're quite right, as you said there, it's always on the weekend that the clocks change. So John and I, you know, the way we come on to this there is that we always used to love the OMS because we both had kids, all that sort of stuff that you're going through now, Claire. And we always used to get an extra hour in bed for the OMS. And we always used to say at that time there was some of the best nights sleep we ever had when we had kids was nights of the OMS. We'd do 10, 11, 12 hours because it's always been about like that weekend because originally then and you do notice the effect of global warming. It's that end of October, so the weather used to be pretty horrendous. The first one we did was an absolute nightmare in terms of what you've noticed is it's got warmer and wetter.
Really?
It's cold, it was frozen shoes, it was all of that sort of stuff.
Wow.
So it was always done for that, you know, it wasn't to be done in the summer, because we also had done the verities that John and I we've done many, he's done over 20, I'm getting onto that sort of way. We've done the Saunders in the Lake District in the summer.
I've pretty done similar that one, event. I think. Did I do that one?
Yeah, it's great. And so for people get that, that's always the first weekend in July. So you have, so we've had this thing like burnt sunshine, horrible rain and snow. So you get the whole gamut of the mountains.
Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah, and also it gets dark, doesn't it, about 4 o'clock in October or 5 o'clock and then 4 o'clock the next day. So
you could be racing to get in before it gets dark, absolutely.
Yeah, well, you've really sold it to us there, Colin. It sounds like a most wonderful event. Can I ask you how you met John and what made you sign up for that first one? Because it was 1986, did you say, that was the first one?
Yeah, the first one there. Yeah. New Galloway, there you go, and that's it. So I met John at university, or as we were there, we went to Sheffield Poly, as it was then, Sheffield Hallam. So we met, we were actually in the same halls in the first year. And I suppose background-wise, I was always quite a big runner and stuff like that. John was a big mountaineer. I think he did a lot, you know, in army-based stuff there. So we both loved the mountains and the hills. And we used to nip in on the bus from Sheffield and go walking in the Peak District, all that good sort of stuff there. And then I think also it helped in what we did with the On There is that we used to disappear into the lakes for, you know, 4 or 5 days and wild camp and all that sort of stuff as students. So we knew each other for the 4 years that we were there. And we used the On as a reason to continue meeting, training. I think we love the training that we do as much as the On itself, because of the time we spend together. And we used it at that time then to continue, you know, the relationship that we had and meeting as good friends, really.
Yeah, I've just put a picture up of you guys on the start line of this year's On, well, last year's now. And you both look just so happy to be there. Like, you're good friends, obviously, and it's just a really nice chance to catch up and get more sleep than usual, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sleeping event, that's it, yeah.
And in terms of training, how did you train for that first one? Were you already fit?
I mean, this is part of one of the reasons, you know, follow your podcast and things that's there now, because training's become so much more of a science. And, you know, what we're talking 86 there is that we were just doing it. The thing we did was to get out in the hills. And I think anybody who does a norm or an event like that, I mean, the big difference is, say, from trail running is, and we found out, you've got to get off the trails. You've got to get off, because the On, as people know, you base there are linear and score courses that they do, but you've really, you've got to make your own track, your own route. You've got to find things, you've got to navigate, you've got to get to those places. And the bulk of your day is going to be off track. If you find runnable ground, that's absolutely brilliant, you know, stuff there. But, you know, you're climbing as well as that. So you know, you follow all the people, I don't know, like Jasmine Paris's of this world, to say, you know, you're going to be doing a lot of hiking. So the way we basically started there, I mean, we were young, we were reasonably fit. We just went off into the Peak District and did a bit of hiking there. And I think as we got older, we progressed our training. And I think the issue as well there, really, because this podcast is for, you know, mid-pack runners there, is that we both had pretty, you know, pretty full-on careers, were great senior roles, travelled a lot, all of that sort of stuff is there. So it, you know, trying to train and get ready for it was always a bit of an art form. And we introduced, certainly when we were getting a bit older there, we had this sort of 6-hour thing. We had this mantra that we did. So we used to start training after in late summer. And we used to do what we call 6 hours. It was 20 miles and 1,000 metres of climb. And so we used to go out and we'd do that.
Yeah.
And that was very, you know, and before... some of that was getting before watches, and now, you know, it's you take, you can't hide from it, you know exactly what you've done, and we can watch it as it's going up there. But, you know, then it was, you know, we get the map out and we just go. And I mean, there's not much of the Peak District. We all, because of where we used to live, we used the Peak District as our training ground, and we used to say that if you used to see two blokes running around the hills with you know, packs on the backs there at that sort of time of year, it was usually John and I. And he sometimes had a dog that we used to take with us there. So we just, that's what we used to do. We used to get in there, and where we could, we'd just get off path quite, you know, we've trodden most of that whole Derwent watershed, all that Peak District area. We know it like the back of our hands now.
Yeah.
And that's what we train on. So, and we just love it. And I think the days that we've had training there together are as, you know, as good as the races that they are themselves.
And, yeah. And so, yeah, it's enjoying it all.
Yeah, that big thing that we always say there is to people, and interestingly enough, this year, when we get onto that, is that this year's race, and we did things, the last year's race, we've moved years now, haven't we? So last year's race, I mean, John and I, we did the Highland Ultra together last year, so a three-day event in Noidart, another superb thing. But we said after the end of the first day there, that was the hardest day in the hills that we'd had last year, and we'd done a lot, was the first day of the Alps.
Oh,
and
really?
And that's, you know, just so you think that, and that's what we reckon it's because we hadn't done enough off-path training.
It's quite interesting hearing you talk about all this because John is actually here right now on the live chat. So he's saying, I'll just read you out some things because you haven't got this in front of you, have you, no. Colin, there? Okay, so he said, in the early years, we only tended to do about 14 miles in training. So
yeah,
he's already debunking the myth. And then he said, we should have done longer distances when we were young. And he said, then we would go off and drink beer. Sounds brilliant.
Yeah, we're really serious athletes, you see, Claire. That's what it is, you see.
Yeah, no, this is brilliant. I think everybody is on board with the beer because Tad says, and more beer, when you were young, he means. And he says, and then Andrea says, being young enables training and beer. And yeah, and John says, yep, we drank quite a lot of beer, to be fair. So there was a lot of beer training going on as well as the running training.
Carbo, that's it.
Well, it's good to welcome John to the show and the podcast as well. So if you're just joining us now, John is Colin's running partner for the OMM and they've done 30 OMMs together. So I just want to, because you've been doing it since the 80s and I was hiking in like the 90s and I remember my mum and dad climbing Kilimanjaro. I remember when head torches were actual little bulbs, not LEDs. I remember Absolutely. Like my mum's Rohan fleece. I remember those backpacks from Berghaus. Absolutely. All the old stuff I remember because I used to use it at school. And so it's really interesting to me how kit has changed over time. So could you just can you like memory lane like back to what you in the 80s and 90s and then compare it to now?
I think there's two aspects to that, and because you look at OMM now and the people that they were there, you used to find when you used to go to the Carrymore, it started for everybody there, it is originally, it was the Carrymore International Mountain Marathon.
Yeah, I remember.
And then it came and carried it up till about early 2000s when Carrymore stopped sponsoring it and OMM took over. So, they used to go there and they used to have these new gear, lightweight cagoules and all that sort of stuff. But no, it was very much, I think the first year we did it, we did it with a Trangia in terms of stone.
Oh, my goodness.
Right?
So I remember Trangias. We had them on D of E.
Absolutely. So that was... I mean, and then I think at that time, Petzl head torches came out, the big ones with the big batteries. They were like, that was...
Yeah, with like a battery this big on the back, like 50, 100 lumen torch, maybe.
And the blooming bulletin, you used to have a spare bulb and all that sort of...
Yeah, I remember
So those were things that you used to have. And I was interested enough there, as you say there, it was the Tim Piggott thing you did last week. I thought the thing that he came out there, he said about 10% of your body weight in terms of your weight before it changes your running style. I've not heard that one before, but I thought it was a really good one. And and it was sleeping bags. I had a damn sleeping bag, but it was huge. You know, tent. I can't remember the first tent we did it with because that was the other thing that's there. And I think, John, now and where we are, I mean, as we've got older and more stupid with our money, we've been able to buy good kit, which is the thing that's there. And I think now there's so much good kit you can get. But, it was those things. You just had more weight, I think, was the thing that's
was
there.
Everything just bigger and bulkier and heavier
back
in the day? Yeah, I feel like that too. Everything's got, like, super light and super thin. But it was very durable, wasn't it, a lot of the stuff back then?
Yeah, and I think also you said there is that, interesting enough, there is that you used to, the OMM sack was, I think you made some comments before about the original, you know, the OMM sack that was, I've still got an old one flying around somewhere there.
Cool.
And that was a 35-litre OMM sack, and you used to be able to get it into there. And the one thing that I said with that, that always used to amaze me, John's sack is always smaller and lighter than my sack. And
yeah.
We've got hours trying to agonise. What's he doing that I'm not? Or what's
he's probably
he
put all his snacks in your bag.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was. And really, those on sacks, you've kept around to that thing. And we're going lighter now, but I think that's because, you know, we've bought better kit, you know, and maybe going to get onto kit later and stuff that out there. But things like stoves now, it's a small,
yeah,
you know, it's just a small thing.
Grams.
And, you know, and the little piece that goes on the top there. So that's massively reduced.
Yeah.
I think always you think there, and you get into there, is that it's water carrying and how much water do you carry? I mean, that's always a thing that you go there. I think we always used to, the memories all we used to have there, we used to have... we used to get the headaches from dehydration headaches because we weren't drinking enough. And,
did you not pick up water on the way round?
So you do, but I think sometimes it's at that time it's frozen, but you don't do it. And I think the thing that, if you look at the Steve Birkinshaws of this world and you read his blog there, he thinks it's horrendous that anybody carries more than, like, you know, half a litre of water.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
I try not to, yeah.
And we what we found that we did there, and you know, we tried with all the different drinks and stuff up there, is that we always used to use bladders because because hydration, because when you go in this, you could be out for hours.
Yeah.
So it was always, you know, how much water do you carry? And we always used to wear on carry more water because you just felt better for it.
But, yeah. You know. And so, I remember that you'd have a hydration bladder and it would come around in that tube. And that was before people thought to, like, put loads of stuff up the front here, like running packs now. I remember all this. And John's come in, he's chipped in about the tent. He said it was the lightest tent that you could get. It was the 2 or 3 kilograms and it was the ultimate phaser dome.
Oh, yeah, right, good, yes, that's it. Yeah. And we had a space packer and now, but I mean, he also almost the tent, you know, people use now. It's a Terra Nova that John's got that everybody uses them, and they're about a kilo now.
Yeah, they are. They can get everything for a kilo. And Andrea says she used those petrels as well, but she used them for caving back in the day. She said they weren't that bright. Yes, I definitely remember those. And then, like, nutrition-wise, a lot obviously has changed in the nutrition arena as well. What kinds of stuff were you taking when you first started out on the OM? Were you those annoying people? Like, I've done 2 mountain marathons, both, like, summery ones. Like, I wouldn't ever venture to the OM. And, like, there's always someone cooking bacon, isn't there, in the morning? Somebody's taken bacon and a freezer pack and they've cooked it. And you're just like, you... and you're there eating your porridge.
If you're gonna carry more weight and you're gonna want something there, is a decent meal is something that is that we've always done. But but yes, so food wise, I mean, it comes back into this, and this is, I think, where things go into sort of the ultra running space that people do now, and nutrition gets a very big thing. The other thing you find there, and within on 2 days as well, you've got to eat. The big thing that you've got, and it is this classic. Doing ultra stuff that's there now, eating during the day, and John's a lot better at it than I am. But we try and get into this hour thing. If you're going up hills, take a bar, and you've got to find some things that you like. I mean, I'm into Tangifastics are my carb, you know, food of choice because I can get them down.
Tangifastics.
The Haribos.
Good choice.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I love them, And you've got to. I almost still now have to force myself to eat. It's so hard.
Yeah.
And there, but you. And it's. I think really it haven't changed that much. I think early days it was muesli bars was the thing you used to have there, and that if you can get those down. And I mean, I'm a savoury person as much as well. There is that, and I'm not averse to a pork pie or a Scotch egg or anything like that. You've got to find what you really can eat, which is the big thing that people are doing these sorts of things.
And the benefit, like, of it being in winter means you can take a pork pie and it won't go off. You know, like, you could eat a pork pie on day 2, safe in the knowledge that it's been freezing or frozen.
And then you're saying about that is that when you're talking about the campsite things, when you've done as many of these OMs as John and I have, you do get to know the people that are there and the people there. And we used to see every year Howard and Mike John will laugh his head off there now, and they were hilarious. We used to see them all the time, and what they used to do was they exactly that same thing. I remember them bringing frozen haddock, smoked haddock and kippers. And they used to fry kippers up for breakfast in the morning.
It was them.
It was
It was them. Well, John says he even thinks that you guys camped next to me on a lamb. And I did do the lamb. Like, the lamb's gone now, isn't it? But I did do the lamb 1 year. And he says that you guys cooked chorizo stew and pasta whilst watching everybody else with their dehydrated stuff. So that could have been the case. I may have met you ages ago. That was donkey's years ago. That was probably like 2016, 17 or something like that. Or even earlier,
that's
maybe.
That's not donkey's years ago, Claire.
2015. Yeah. Yeah, and Jonathan remembers Howard and Mike Kippers for breakfast as well. Yeah, once I made this really bad error, I put an electrolyte tablet into my pasta because I thought, oh, that'll just zing it up a bit. It'll just taste a bit orangey. And it tasted so disgusting that I could hardly even eat it. But I had to eat it because it was the only thing I had. I was so sad that day. Oh, Jonathan said that one wasn't with Colin. So he's done other OMS without you.
Oh, yeah.
He's done other mountain marathons without you. How dare he?
We had another friend that, so yeah, we did it. He was lucky because I think you go back to this in terms of wives that were there. He always used to go and do the Lama. I could never get away with that because I used to do the Saunders and the OM, and then because you go this, it's quite a commitment when we've done them as there. It's because you know you disappear for 3-4 days basically there. So so and the other funny story like this one, Claire, as well there is that interestingly enough, John's wife's birthday is on the 28th of October.
Every year he misses his wife's birthday.
So there we have the laughter there with Claire there is that I've spent more nights on Claire's birthday in a in a tent with John than she has.
And she's called Claire as well.
She's called Claire as
well. Oh, what a good name. so who does John do his lambs with if he doesn't do them with you?
Because he's got a friend, Andy, who did there, but I think his hips have gone now, so he's not able to do them,
Well, he says it was the lamb at Crucian, and I wrote about it for Trail Running Magazine. That was an amazing lamb. Oh, I loved it. It was such beautiful scenery. It was up in the north of Scotland somewhere or other, and it was really hard work, but it was amazing. He said he's also sprinkled milk powder over chorizo instead of Parmesan. That's a fair enough thing to do. And lambs were a 40th birthday present for him 1 year, and then he just carried on. He was cheating with Andy, his other partner. That's what he says. This is a good group chat, isn't it? So talking of cheating, how was the sleep? Because you said you guys have never had a fight, so, you know, like no one's robbed a bit of duvet or anything, because you're really sandwiched in, aren't you, on those tents? How close are you? Give us an impression.
Yeah, I mean, a bit of advice I'd give as well for people who want to do more than one mountain marathon is find somebody who they can get on with, because I think that's a key thing. We've shared some of the smelliest, dirtiest, horriblest places I think ever in there. And two things really is that don't scrimp on a sleeping mat. All these people there, I think even more so nowadays, they're good for, because the other thing about these sorts of things, you like it to get wet, so you've got something that keeps you off the floor, brilliant. But a good sleeping mat what's the wrong word there? Say you have to learn to spoon sometimes, I suppose. That's the guess. But no, we're fine. And if you can, top and tail, I think, is another good thing that you can do there. But that depends on if you've
bit
got
more
a good
room.
Yeah.
But then you've got someone's feet in your face, which is not always ideal.
That's it.
And so we've covered kit and nutrition and sleep. I just want to talk to you a little bit about navigation, because that maybe is one of the things that hasn't changed quite so much, because you're surely not allowed to use a GPS watch on the OM.
No.
So maybe that's one of the aspects that hasn't actually changed that much. And I know that one of our other patrons, Hannah Neal, or Hannah Basley, she was interested to know a few tips about navigation that you've kind of gleaned over the years. What's the nav like on the OM? Is there different levels?
And I think it's actually got easier because of the fact that one simple thing there, and John and I were talking about this, is that now they mark your maps for you.
Oh, do they?
So when you started, you know, in 86 in the good old days.
Yeah, you'd have to draw
I sound like your dad now, don't I?
No, honest, I'm older than... How old do you think I am?
I think I do know because you put it in one of your things up there. But yeah,
so I'm 40 in
February. Yeah, you're just big 4,
so I am a lot older than a lot of people think I am, and I'm just very immature. So a lot of people think I'm like 20 or something. I got ID'd in Morrison's the other day. I was so
brilliant.
Happy. Yeah. I was like, I'm nearly 40. I remember. Oh, what were we talking about? Navigation.
The way the courses work, there are two types of courses in the on there. You can do what are called linear courses, which they give you 8, 10 checkpoints and you do them in order. Or there's a score class that people do there, which they just give you loads and they've got points and you go around and who gets the most points wins, sort of points makes prizes type of thing that's there.
Yeah.
So, and the first thing you used to have there was marking your map right.
Yeah, with grid references.
And sometimes it was belting it down with rain and what did you use and all that sort of stuff was there. So that always used to become a thing, and we used to do it and then check each other's map, that sort of stuff there, which is always a big thing at that time, because you can mark it wrong and you've just gone somewhere totally wrong. Now they're all marked, so that's a big thing there.
And John says the maps are now waterproof, and you used to have a paper map and keep it in a plastic bag, and I remember that, like getting a pencil and going under the bag and circling things, because when I did Tour de Trix when I was 17, that would have been like 1998 or 9 or something, and we did 50 miles, we had to circle it all to start with, and that was part of the time, like you didn't get that time back. That was part of the
absolutely
competition.
The moment you go,
everyone's gone soft.
Absolutely. So you go to there, and I think the big thing you said, a bit like you, Claire, I was brought up from a very early age, you know, with different things like map and compass, navigation. There's no such thing as GPS or watches or anything like that.
Yeah, so, I've only used that once on Cape Wrath Ultra, and I was like, I need the map.
Yeah,
but I'm not very. I would just add, I'm not very good at map reading, but I can, you know, I can get myself around.
Yeah, so you've got to learn, and the thing there is that. Nowadays they've not banned phones and watches in these events now, because I think it's just so difficult to police. But I think it's one of those things that we were having this conversation as well, John and I, recently about the fact that we can't believe that people aren't looking at the watches and phones now for things like that. But the spirit of the event is you don't use any of that and you just use map and compass. So you've got to practice. You've got to get in there and be comfortable with a map. And I think for me, there's always a thing. And many of these are often, you know, a few miles apart there. And there's two types of navigation for me there. There's the navigation to get you into the area, so you know which is the best way to go. And then there's the quite pinpoint navigation, because I think the amount of time I spent running around the mountain looking for a re-entrance. And if you don't know what blooming re-entrance.
What even is a re-entrance? Like, what the hell is it? I never knew. I learned orienteering at school when I was like 15.
And they call it
re-entrance.
The moment you see re-entrance, you go, there we go.
It's like a dip, isn't it? It's like the opposite
of a
spur.
Or a start of a water course or something like that.
It's just a big dip, a big ditch, usually full of water and bog.
And so you then get into that finer nav where you basically have to look at it. And I think the other tip I'd give for people when they are giving navigation there, and what is really hard, and we've tripped up a bit this year on it as well there, is that if you know what moving a kilometre is like in terms of time and distance, and you get a feel for what a kilometre is, which is a grid square on your map, that's the sort of, if you know what that is and how long it takes you to do it, and those are good things when you, because you usually find you somewhere, and then, you know, you've got to find this, and people see the orienteering marker, you can waste a hell of a load of time you know, trying to find these things if your navigation's not good. You've then got to basically, you know, look for things there. So that's when things get serious, and often we spread, two of us. So, and often when it's really, really foggy and the clags down and that sort of stuff there is that, you know, you keep us distance so you can see each other, and then you go for it and try and find it using that finer navigation that you see from the map. So those are sorts of things you've got to get comfortable with. And sometimes, and the classic thing there is don't follow people.
Oh, yeah. Or flattened bits of grass where you think people have gone.
Yeah, because what you do find there as well is that lots of different classes, lots of people going all over the place. So, you know, you can maybe have a look at it in there, and there you get an idea. But yes, you can really trip up if you think, oh, I'll follow that person and do that. But yeah,
you've got to run your own
and it becomes much more of an issue when it's mistier and claggier than something like summer. or great visibility. You know, you go, whoa, great, you can see it. You can see a knoll for miles away, but sometimes you've got to hit a knoll in the middle of nowhere, and you can't see more than about 50 yards. So it's, you know, it's, you've got to get comfortable with being in that sort of environment if you want to. Enjoy yourself.
Yes, enjoy
and not
yourself.
Argue.
Also, John's just come in here. I've just put a little picture up of you and him having found a checkpoint. So they're orange and white triangle marked flag things. And this one's near a stream. It's very misty. It looks very featureless, this bog. And Jonathan's also said something which is interesting, because this wouldn't have happened in the 80s and 90s. He says, if you're close to the checkpoint and you can't see it, you can sometimes hear it beep as people dib. So yes, now you wear these like little like concert wristband things, and they've got a plastic dibber, and you just have to dib it in, like, and it goes beep like that and goes red. But in the olden day, you used to have a card, didn't you? And you used to had different prongs on the punch, and you punched it down, and you had to do it in the right order. If you got it in the wrong order, you were toast, weren't you?
Absolutely.
So you had to check that you were at the right one, because even if you'd gone too far and got the next one by accident, if you put it in the right hole, you could go back and you could still save the linear course. It's changed so much, hasn't it? Because I used to do orienteering at school, so this is like the times you were doing the on. And he said,
and
also,
people are not doing this and they want to, you know, get into the, one thing I'd always suggest to people there is there are plenty of orienteering clubs around that do events, and you can just rock up. Try some simple orienteering events just to get comfortable with map, compass, finding things. That's always, you know, a useful tip if people are not comfortable with that. Go to an orienteering event. There are loads of them around the place. It's amazing.
It's a really good place to get started. And they're small courses, and they're often like at your local country park, so you might know it a little bit, and that helps to start with. And Jonathan says also people bending down can be a good indicator of a checkpoint. Either that or they're going for a sneaky wee. So that's it. That's a good one as well. So you say that you and John have never argued. Why do you think that is? Like, because I've seen people having
we've seen people having howlers.
Yeah, have you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's two things. I think what causes that. I think, you know, when people are going to do mountain marathons of this type, I think what you'll find is that if I went there and if you do with people who have a sort of a similar ability, it's fine. I see a lot of tension comes in when somebody's of a much better able runner and they don't like waiting for, because the other thing about these events as well, and I think quite different to what a lot of people get in trail running, is these are team events. It's about the two of you. If you don't both get over the line, you're toast again, and you can't see. You have to look after the person that you're with, you know, and that you get the best out of them if you two are moving, you know, in tandem sort of together. I think there is that what stops arguing is if people are of a simple mind. We always used to start, I think, first objective when John and I went out there was to finish. On some of the OM events, you could get 50% dropout in terms of classes of people not finishing. You know, that was not, and you go into the elite classes even now, and I mean, God, I think less people finish than start. You know, that sort of stuff is there. So maybe some of the other classes not so like we're doing there. But you know, the first objective for us was finish.
Did you finish the 2008 event? Do you remember the one which was really wet?
Well, nobody did. But, I mean, that's Borrowdale for people.
Oh, no one did. Okay, did they cancel it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it got flooded off. We didn't talk of biblical floods and the like there. Look it up on YouTube. It's hilarious. We would have finished the first day. John and I were there. Yeah, it's a bit wet and windy, you know, sort of things there. But the whole issue, I think, was that the whole event centre got flooded out and all of that sort of stuff there. But we were on the top. That was in the Lake District as well. And we were actually on the top of Dale Head, and the next checkpoint was go down the ridge, or we looked at it and we were getting probably blown over at that point. And we just hunkered down. We said, we looked at the map and said, well, the simplest thing to do is just go down the road and pick up from the checkpoint, because it was quicker. and so we actually pegged down from Dale Head, and at that point there's somebody on the road saying it's called off, and we walked back to the event centre. And the lucky thing we had there is that starts of these sorts of things are staggered through the. We had a really late start that day. Unfortunately, we parked our car off the off the parking field of where it was, and most people's cars got flooded out, and ours didn't. So we got out straight away. I mean, it was quite funny. That was because my wife is staying in the Lake District with our kids, because often I've stayed in the lakes after or near where we've been with the family afterwards, So we arrived up and dropped there, and they said, "What are you two doing here?" And all across the news was this whole thing, this adventure race gone wrong, and it wasn't. And I think the great thing they said there is, if you're going to lose 2,000 people on the hills, the people to lose on the hills were the people who were doing the on, because we're the most capable people to do it. I think there were about 20 people from mountain rescue teams who were actually event people on there.
Yeah.
And I think they only had one minor injury, as somebody who'd sprained their ankle or something daft like that. Because most of the people out there thought, well, let's stay in the hills. It's what we've come for.
Fine.
What's the problem?
I know. And Jonathan is coming back in. He said, "I think we did at least two that were worse than Borrowdale in 2008. People had gone soft by then. There was a lot of health and safety that started to come in."
Oh yeah.
And he also I didn't get to read this out just when we were talking about the in the olden days. He was saying with the punch cards in the olden days, they had to be checked, so you didn't know if you'd actually successfully completed until the results came back in the post. Everything just took a lot longer. It was bigger, bulkier, took longer, and it was all a bit slower moving. So,
but it still worked.
Yeah, it still worked. Yeah. So we've talked about quite a lot of things, and you've given loads of great advice here for people who might want to do the OM, or they might want to start orienteering or going to. There's an event called the OM Light as well that we've currently. If you're a patron, you might be able to win an entry to the OM Light, and that's
great start.
That's a really really good start. It's basically it's 3rd and 4th of June, and you go around navigating. I think it's a score course. You navigate to as many as you can in the set time, but that is a fact. That's that it's easier than the OM, isn't it? And you don't have to carry everything on your back because it's a festival village, and you go out.
It's in Grasmere. I think it's in Grasmere.
Yeah, it's part of the Grasmere sports, the Grasmere festival that Gaynor Prior organises. So there's also 5K, 10K, half marathon, and marathon trail running events there as well. So if you're not already a patron, then you won't be automatically entered to win that. So just go on the website and have a look at that, because it looks really, really good.
There's another really good event that Shane Oley does that John and I do.
Lakes in a Day.
It's the Great Lakeland 3 Day.
Oh, Great Lakeland 3 Day. That's what I thought I was saying in my head.
And we did it in 2021, and that's really good. There is nav in there, but they say it's on trails there, but if people want to get an idea for it, and with that, it's done from a one campsite, so you're out and back in the day, and then you do it for 3 days if you've got the time and stuff. There, that's a really good introduction. Yeah. Not having to. So there are a number of events like that. They say they said nav wasn't a big issue there, but John and I didn't thought. Yeah, the nav isn't. If you need to be reasonably, you'll get a good experience of what finding checkpoints is like with an event like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you just need to go and do it, don't you? I mean, like go and do some orienteering locally, but also a really good idea is to go on a navigation course as well, isn't there? There's lots of people that run these. They're not that expensive. I don't know. It's like maybe 40 quid for a day.
They're great events. And I think
you just let the basics, and then you can go off and plan your own routes and do everything yourself.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of mid-pack runners like us there, you know, they sit there, they're great, because the other thing that we always used to find, why do you do OMs there? They make you think. You cannot relax. You know what I say about this? Is that you do end one of these races even more mentally tired than you would do a trail race or stuff like that. Because there's a lot of concentration that you have to do with your navigation, which is always a big attraction for me with it.
Yeah, it takes your mind off the actual running, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
I have a love-hate relationship with orienteering. Like, it's so frustrating when you get it wrong, isn't it? Like, I just hate getting stuff wrong. It's horrible. But yeah, if you go in with the right attitude, it can be really good. So I was just going to say we've had some really good tips there for newcomers to the OM. But what would you say is the biggest tip that you could give somebody who really wants to do the actual OM, like this October? What would be the biggest tip from you that they could do during this year to prepare for it?
So again, it's that thing is that it's don't think you're going to do some trail running and stuff like that and you're going to enjoy the on, because you're not. You've got to get comfortable with being off track. And I think there is this big thing like, you know, spines going on at the moment there, and you listen to all the people training at the front at the moment there. They've got to get used to this thing. Hiking is one of those things as well, because, you know, the top guys as well, yeah, you know, even in the elite classes there, they're, if they get going over 4 miles an hour, you know, miles an hour on that sort of terrain, that sort of stuff there, that's, you know,
that's zooming.
It's zooming. So you just need to be comfortable and certainly put in some of your training there, off path stuff, because it uses different muscles, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So really breaking that training up is a huge thing that you need to do. And the other thing there is that you've got to try your kit out. I mean, I think, you know, say with Eric, John and I can put a tent up in any weather and whatever it is now, you know, we're comfortable with it. But you talk about frustration, just don't go there with a tent that you don't know how to put up, like that, you see, yeah. Or a stove that you don't know how to, you know, start, and all these sorts of stuff that's there. So it is just be comfortable with your kit and try your food as well. We're not talking about food is said there. Is that be comfortable with what meal you're going to have, and a pot noodle doesn't do it for anybody. Whatever they say there is that you need something substantial, and there's good lightweight stuff. A lot of people do packets, can't hate them myself, but the stuff that's there is, but you know, you can do rice, you can do pasta, there are great sauces and stuff like that, you know, and you know, cheeses you can get in sachets. That's just some real food, is there? Anybody, you know, all the nutritionists say it, don't they? There is some real food, so and you do need it. So really, is don't just go there not having tried the stuff that you can use, I think would be the biggest advice. If you're going to want to enjoy it anyway.
Yeah, it sounds like the advice is practice, every single aspect. And John's got a tip as well. He says his biggest tip is to do long days out in the wild with some off track, like you were saying, and carrying a realistic amount of gear, and like maybe a bit more than realistic amount of gear, like hiking with a bigger bag, like tabbing.
I think, you know, great one is the pit of my training there. Is Jasmine Paris always used to say this, you know, there. And she used to, all the stuff she does there, she used to say, what's the best training for long days in the hills? And she'd go, long days in the hills.
Yeah.
You know, and which is so true. And hiking, I mean, that's what, you know, John and I, you know, are very lucky now is that we, both of us aren't working now. And what we've been doing now is regularly on a Thursday, we'll meet up somewhere and we're going to have a long day in the hills. We're running out, that's it, and stuff there. And that's what just to get your body used to being out, because you are going to be out for 6, 7, 8 hours, and you know, easily if you go wrong or something like that. So you have to be used to, you know, younger people do this, but as you get older, you have to get used to being out in the hills for that length of time.
Yeah.
That's exactly as you say, and some weight on your back.
Yeah, and John says also crap weather as well. So don't just wait till it gets nice, because it won't be nice on the arm.
You can
guarantee that. Yeah. And so congratulations. I just want to say congratulations because you've done 30 years pairing together. How did you celebrate the finish? I'm going to put the picture up of you finishing now. That's not the picture of you finishing. This is a picture of you two looking quite soggy at the finish, but big smile still.
Yeah.
And then they made you a patch, didn't they? An om patch with 30 written on it. So
yeah, 30 years club. There's this club they do for 30 years there. So that's it. So a bit, I've been doing some two things. First, that there, I did some research into this with the om people there, and there is another pair that have done 30 together, but they've stopped now. There's another pair that have done 30 oms.
And who is that? Is that Wendy?
I don't know the names of the
guys. I bet it's Wendy Dodds and her running partner.
It's not Wendy, no. That's it. And that's a funny one there. John came back to me there. He beat Wendy Dodds in a race for then. And said that, so he got to that point where he was happy beating a 70-year-old lady running around the hills, and that was his major achievement.
She's not any old 70-year-old lady, though, is she?
No.
I remember she was 61 doing the Dragon's Back race.
Yes.
like in 2012. Absolutely. She had the number 61 on her because she was like 61. And I remember seeing her come in at the finish and people were crying because they were just like, oh my God, it's such an amazing achievement. So she's amazing.
This year we, great thing, John's wife Claire, because it was her birthday again, as you can imagine. So they'd had a cottage in the lake, so we went to the pub basically. So there's a bit of there. So yes, toasted, had a few pints in Grasmere, I think it was, were this year.
Yeah, I was just going to say, how do you usually recover after these things, apart from the beer?
So I think usually find that time of year. I always used to basically then. I just had some time off because usually at that time of there is the with things there and work and all that sort of stuff. I used to really throttle back the training then until the beginning into the new year, because where we got into a cycle was that work was always difficult, but we used to do the Saunders in July, so that almost got us going, and we did an event there. So, and it was usually in the summer, so we'd done a mountain race in the summer. And then we used to, after summer holidays, that's when we'd then pick up that training things we do, and we're trying to get most weekends, we'd try and get into the peaks and run there. So that was sort of the mid-pack runner sort of cycle that we got into to do these events. And it was, days in the hills again was the thing there. So that's, I suppose, how that sort of worked its way through.
Yeah, and then you just recovered by dropping it all down again.
So you'd normally find, I think, some of the stiffest legs I've had have been after OMS sometimes there. And you just, I think, as all these people say there, you've done ultras and stuff like that, don't do anything for a week or two. It's the best advice, and stretch and get back and then start again when you feel comfortable to do it. And I think that time of year as well, after you've done an OMS, there's not much going on.
You can chill out for a bit.
It's a good time to have a chill out point in the year.
Yeah, celebrate before Christmas, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, John is already saying, I will drag Colin round the 31st if I have to. as well as saying, overtaking Wendy Dodds is probably the highlight of my running career. So if this does beg the question, Colin, will you be going for the 40 together, 40 events together?
The pack that John and I have got is that we're going to go until we fall to bits.
Oh, brilliant. So 50, maybe even 60.
So the thing about it there is that if we're fit enough, we'll be going. And I think that's the thing. So we may be getting slower, but this is where, you get into a whole thing about the great thing there. I mean, you got me into that one, Claire.
Oh, that is good. I have had a lot of views of that YouTube channel.
I remember that one when you interviewed him.
For anyone watching, listening to the podcast, Colin's just held up the book Fast After 50 by Joe Friel, who I've interviewed on the channel. I'll link to it. I'll link to Joe Friel's interview and also all the navigation stuff on the channel. I'll put that in the show notes and in the film description below. But yeah, that's a really good one. That's had loads of views. I bet Joe's sold loads of books off that. It's brilliant.
So I mean, there's a whole piece now you can get about old age, mid-pack runners and stuff there, but you've now got to train smarter. I mean, John's really good on big days, but I think that was something you were talking about recently. What I'm going to do now is really look at how you can train smarter for somebody as you get older, and it isn't just volume. I mean, I've got sort of three mantras I use at the moment there for training, which is basically, a lot of it comes from Joe and other people who talk about this. I don't run more than four times a week. I may bike or hike or something there, but you don't run more than four times a week. I certainly do the 80-20 heart rate training, low intensity stuff that's there, so that's good. And strength and conditioning is just the huge one for people our age, because we're losing muscle mass, so that's big. And I think John's the same on that as well there now, is that's something you really got to introduce into what you're doing. So those are, and if you can keep those going, I think the big disaster is going to be when a hip or a knee or something like that goes, and that's when you're going to have to put us out to grass and put us down, or the shoot horses, don't they, or something
we'll
like that.
Shoot you.
So no, there's no desire to stop anyway, Claire.
Yeah. Oh well, I think you'll get 40, and maybe even 50, like 50 OMS would be incredible, and it's such an achievement. They'd probably make you come and do all those talks. You know, like they've got little talks like beforehand, and you'd probably be wheeled out for that, wouldn't you? And yeah.
So that's that. So if we, so what? That'd be at least 20, wow.
20 years.
80.
You'd be 80. It'd be good going if you could do. But I mean, you can do this like the shortest score course possible and just get one control. You've still done an arm, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah. when the big 6-0 this year, John and I, both of us.
Yeah, you're 60 this year.
Yeah, that's it.
Both of us. Congratulations. Yeah. Same age. Yeah, well, you don't look a day over 21.
Day over 65, my daughter would say to me.
Yeah. Aww. Oh, well, it's been really fantastic to chat to you both, John on the live chat and Colin there at home. And it sounds absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for all the tips. I think everybody's got a really good impression of what the arm is, what's required for the arm, and how you could train up for it. And you're making me feel like I even want to do one now. So maybe I'll see you on one.
I'd forget your 100 miler, Claire, and just go for the arm.
Just do it harder.
Certainly. I mean, seriously, for people there, is that if they're looking for something that's going to really challenge them, a bit different. If they've got a good friend as well that they like running with, try one of these. There's the summer one, do the Saunders as well. That's really good.
Go for the if you don't,
if you know, if you know, if you're worried about the weather and the cold, a lot of people say I don't do it because it's cold and wet, but I mean, we love cold and wet, so it's just stuff that's there. So.
You've got to in the UK, haven't you?
So it's really something that I think Vassos Alexander, he does a lot of stuff there. He says it's one of the, it was on his bucket list thing of the things, races that he had to do there.
I think he did that. To so, do one, didn't he?
So it really is worth people trying it just to, mix up the things that they do.
Yeah. Oh, Vassos did do one with Stuart Smith, I think.
Yeah, that was right, yeah. We saw him one, but he's seen them. We've had all the greats running past us in things there. So
I don't think he liked it. I don't know if it was sharing a tent with Stuart. Sorry, Stuart. But I don't think he liked it because Stuart's like shorter and rounder. Sorry, Stuart. He is my friend. He won't mind me saying this. Yeah, I've made him famous anyway by talking about him. And Vassos is very tall and thin, isn't he? So I can imagine the tent space was a bit like, I don't know, maybe Vassos was a bit traumatised about spooning, maybe. We can't speak for him. I'll ask him when I next see him.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've made me definitely think about doing more nav stuff, and with training for this 100 I need to get out into the mountains, so I maybe should plan myself some routes and navigate myself around some things. It's very inspiring, and whenever I talk to anybody on these live shows I'm always like, oh yes, I could get back into that, and I'll just get back into that. I can't wait to retire. It'd be brilliant.
We did loads of these really while we're holding down two pretty full-on jobs, you see, we did that, so you can do it. And we're never going to win. I think we made a chasing start a few times, and that's about as good as we got there. But if you love days in the hills and running, I think why you do these is that you run, you travel in the hills faster than you would do if you were hiking. Is a great thing about it, and you see lots of different places that and weird places. So you still do it in the lakes, and you think you know the lakes, and if you do an om in the lakes, you go to places you never where are we here? So it's just average people can do these things, and just go for it.
Brilliant. Oh, well, that sounds like a great place to end the interview. Thank you so much to Colin and to John as well. And hopefully we'll see you all at the OM in 2023.
Yeah, we certainly will.
Cool. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.